Hope you're looking forward to the weekend. No doubt about that. Okay, so we finally get to start on some GR this morning. but I've already given you the basic idea, which is that we've already seen how EtaMuNu is used to define Lorentz invariant distances. And inner products. And so if x prime mu is lambda mu nu x nu, then eta mu nu dx prime mu dx prime nu equals eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, so distances measured, distances defined with eta or inner products. Similarly, eta mu nu a mu b nu, if a and b are two vectors, then this is also invariant. So it's very natural because it can be used to define distances to call it the metric. It's like the meter. And what I want to show to you now is that, in fact, the most general, coordinate transformation satisfying star most general coordinate transformations are Lorentz plus translations, which is the Poincaré group. Okay, so let's see how to prove it, and it's sufficient to prove that we want to. So we're going to insist that eta gamma delta equals eta alpha beta dx prime alpha dx gamma dx prime beta dx delta. Okay, one can go from here to there or vice versa. And we're just going to impose that equation, but allow x prime alpha to be any function of x gamma. Actually, change these indices. Okay, so just to keep the notation short, let me call this, I'm going to write this as eta mu nu x prime mu comma alpha x prime nu comma beta, as we did before. These matrices, by the way, are the Jacobian matrices. These are the matrices which take you from infinitesimal dx to infinitesimal dx prime. Okay, is dx prime mu dx alpha dx alpha. So this is the Jacobian matrix. And if the transformation is one-to-one, these matrices are invertible. If the map x to x prime alpha is one-to-one. So we're going to assume this is invertible. And now the trick is very simple. We just differentiate this equation. And the left-hand side is a constant, so that's always going to give zero. So let's apply d gamma. Differentiating this equation with respect to gamma, I get x prime mu comma alpha gamma x prime nu eta mu nu plus x prime mu comma alpha x prime nu comma beta gamma eta mu nu equals zero. Okay, so I just differentiated this equation with respect to gamma, and the left-hand side was zero. And now we're going to use a trick, which I think we're going to use four times in the next lecture. It's always the same trick of algebra, which is to cycle these indices. See, there are three free indices. And, sorry, should be three free indices. Here is a beta, yes. There we go. So there are three free indices, and we're just going to go through all the cycles. This is an object that's symmetric on the first two indices because partial derivatives commute. And so whenever you see something with three indices, two of which are symmetric, you use the following trick. Okay, so the trick is just to cycle the indices. So let's say alpha goes to gamma. Gamma goes to beta. I'm just shuttling these indices around, these three indices. So alpha goes to gamma goes to beta, and beta goes to alpha. Okay, likewise, I can shuffle the indices. So gamma goes to beta goes to alpha, and alpha goes to gamma. Okay, and everything else is the same, so I won't write it down. Here, alpha went to gamma. Beta went to alpha, and gamma went to beta. And over here, gamma went to beta, alpha went to gamma, and beta went to alpha. Okay, so is that clear? I'm just going vertically. Alpha goes to gamma goes to beta, gamma goes to beta goes to alpha, etc. Okay, so why do we do that? Well, the point is that some of these terms are now identical. And so in particular, if I put a minus sign in front of this, so this equals zero, okay, but this term is identical to that term because these partial derivatives commute. It's symmetric on these first two indices. So if I add this equation to that equation, this will cancel. These two terms will cancel. Okay. Likewise, this and that term are identical because alpha, I have alpha, beta, and beta, alpha. So this will cancel this. If I add this term. And so we put all that together, and we see what we're left with is eta mu nu x prime mu comma alpha gamma x prime nu comma beta equals zero. Why? Because these two terms are identical. This is alpha gamma, this is gamma alpha. and it's symmetrical. Now, I told you this is an invertible matrix, this Jacobian matrix. So we can just multiply by the inverse and remove that matrix. Likewise, eta is invertible, so we can remove the eta. And we're left with x prime mu comma alpha gamma equals 0. So this is invertible. This is invertible. So we can just remove them from the equation, and we're left with this. Now that just means that x, the second derivative of x prime is 0, so that means x must be linear. And so that's the general solution. Any questions? Okay. So we're going to use the same trick again and again. And this was based, as far as I know, this trick was really what Riemann discovered when trying to set up Riemannian geometry. And you'll see why in a moment. Among others, among many others. But this one was the fundamental trick. So the idea is to generalize this. Generalize by replacing eta mu nu with g mu nu of x, which can be any 4x4 symmetric matrix. Symmetric invertible matrix. Function on function of the x alpha. Okay, so as I mentioned before, when I put an x alpha inside the argument, it doesn't mean there's an index. It's just to indicate this is a function of those four coordinates. And with the transformation rule, that g prime mu nu of x prime is equal to g alpha beta of x dx alpha dx prime mu dx beta dx prime nu. And so the idea is that this g is going to, the explicit form of G is going to depend on coordinates. So it's different than eta in that respect. When we do special relativity, we insist that the metric doesn't change under coordinate transformations. In general relativity, we allow it to change. G mu nu can be anything. And what we say is that these coordinates, because they're completely general, we could make any coordinate transformation we wish. The form of the metric is also very general. And what we say is that the coordinates are not meaningful things. The coordinates are just devices we use to trace, to do calculations. So the coordinates you should think of as some kind of grid on space-time. Space-time will be a curved manifold or curved surface, and the coordinates are just devices we use to do calculations, but they have no intrinsic meaning. Okay, the thing which does have meaning is the geometry of space-time. So there are certain things you can calculate in space-time, like its curvature or the length of paths, the coordinate invariant length of paths and between two points, and those kind of quantities do have meaning, which is independent of the coordinates. Now, what is the connection between these two ideas? The first thing you can show that it is always possible to choose coordinates in the neighborhood, let's say in a sufficiently small neighborhood, neighborhood of a point such that G menu such that G menu equals eta menu at that point. And the first derivative, G mu nu, comma alpha, equals 0 at that point. Okay, so intuitively you can think of the space you're describing as some curved space. And locally, at any point, I can draw a tangent space, which is a flat space. And if I stay sufficiently, well, within that space, within that, so I can use this flat space to describe the immediate vicinity of the point, and the metric on this flat space will be eta. Okay, now you can set the first derivative 0, but you cannot set all the second derivative 0. And what is that? That is telling you is that the corrections to the metric go like x squared, where x is the distance, or x is the displacement, let's say, from that point. Let me say order delta x squared, where delta x is the displacement from that point. So locally, for any smooth manifold, in fact, this is the definition of a differentiable manifold, that locally in the neighborhood of any point, you can choose coordinates in which the metric is flat. There's a slight distinction because Riemann did this for spaces which are locally Euclidean space, flat Euclidean space. But of course, Einstein did it for space-time, which is locally Minkowski space. So there's just a minus sign difference, and that's called pseudo-Riemannian geometry instead of Riemannian geometry. But the principle is exactly the same. So let's prove that. If I've got a G mu nu, and I'm allowed to change coordinates, okay, so somebody gives me a manifold, some sort of space with coordinates on it, and this metric, G alpha beta of x, and then I'm free to change the metric according to this equation. The statement is that I can choose x of x prime such that G will satisfy these two equations. Let me say it this way. A coordinate transformation, of course, takes x to x prime or x prime to x. And if it's one to one, it's invertible. Okay, so you can view it either way. It's convenient when looking at this equation to look at this as x being a function of x prime rather than x prime being a function of x. But if the map is one to one, those are completely equivalent. So let us assume, so the proof, assume g alpha beta of x is a smooth function, which means it has a Taylor series. And I'm going to pick, just for convenience, I'm going to pick this point here to be 0, x equals 0. That's an arbitrary choice, but you see it'll just make the algebra a little bit easier. So the metric near x equals 0 is given by a Taylor series, alpha, beta, comma, lambda, x lambda, plus 1/2 b alpha, beta, comma, lambda, sigma, x lambda, x sigma, plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so that's just a Taylor series in many coordinates, where a alpha beta comma lambda is the lambda derivative of g alpha beta at x equals 0. So if I take d by d lambda of this, of course that'll go away. This one will give a term of order x. As I take x to 0, I'm going to get that. So this is a Taylor series. And then we're going to assume that x alpha is a Taylor series in x prime. And again, I'm going to assume for convenience that x equals 0 maps to x prime equals 0. It's, again, just to simplify the algebra. Okay, so x is likewise going to have a Taylor series expansion in x prime, x alpha gamma delta x prime gamma x prime delta plus 1/6 m alpha gamma delta x prime gamma, should be an epsilon, x prime delta x prime epsilon plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so then the statement made over here is that we can choose k and l such that g prime is equal to, this new metric is equal to eta at x prime equals 0, and the first derivative of g prime is 0. Okay, the statement is there's sufficient freedom in k, l, and m that you can do that. We will use M momentarily, but we'll satisfy that statement there with just K and L, and then we'll see there's still some freedom in M to affect the second derivatives of G, and that will be very important in identifying what we call the Riemann curvature. So the statement is that we can choose K and L to set G prime mu nu of 0 equal to eta mu nu and G and D alpha G prime mu nu at 0 to be 0. I'll write it this way, then it makes it clear. G mu nu comma alpha prime. Okay, so the proof works just by substituting in. Let's just calculate the top equation, g prime mu nu of 0. I put this expression in for g. When I set x equals 0, all I get is that. I put this expression in for x. I take first derivatives using the dx dx prime, and all I get is k. Okay, so g prime mu nu of 0 is g alpha beta of 0 times k alpha mu k beta nu. Well, what's that equation? If I write this as a matrix, i.e., g prime is k transpose g k. Okay, as we did before, you see this is working the wrong way for a matrix product. You're supposed to multiply the column by the row. But if you transpose K, it's correct to be the matrix product. And G is some arbitrary 4x4 symmetric matrix. Now, it's symmetric, so the first thing you can do is try to diagonalize it. So if we set... So G is symmetric. Symmetric. So there exists an O, an orthogonal matrix, such that O transpose G O is D, which is diagonal. We're going to assume. And I should have stated this earlier. G is a 4x4 symmetric invertible matrix with eigenvalues, with three positive eigenvalues and one negative eigenvalue. Okay. None of this will work unless G has that form, because the sign of the eigenvalues, which is called a signature, is invariant under these coordinate transformations. So I'm going to assume my G has three positive eigenvalues, one for each space direction and one negative for the time direction. So that means that when you diagonalize it, the eigenvalues, the diagonal matrix, which is the matrix of eigenvalues, is L2 squared, L3 squared, 0, 0, 0. Okay. Where L0, 1, 2, 3 are real numbers. So those eigenvalues, 1 is negative and 3 are positive. 3 positive, 1 negative. Eigenvalue. But then all we do is we say that if k equals OL, where L is the diagonal matrix, where L is 1 over L1, L0, 1 over L1, 1 over L2, 1 over L3, zeros everywhere else. Then K transpose GK is L transpose, which is the same as L, O transpose GO. L, which is LDL, which is minus 1, 1, 1, 1, which is eta. Okay, so there's just enough freedom in K to ensure that G prime equals eta. Okay, so we've satisfied the first condition. Now we look at the second condition. G, so similarly, G prime mu nu comma lambda at zero. So what do I have to do? I take the derivative of the first term, the G up there. I'm differentiating. Yeah, so I have to do a couple of things. I write G as a function of X, but X is a function of X prime, okay? And now I'm differentiating with respect to X prime in this equation. This is the derivative with respect to X prime, because it's all primed, okay? So I have to plug the second line into the, I plug that formula for X into the formula for G, put both of them in the first line, and work out all the terms which are non-zero when X prime is zero. And so what I get is A alpha beta comma delta, K delta lambda, K alpha mu, K beta nu. You can see where that one comes from. That comes from differentiating. When I differentiate with respect to X prime, I differentiate the first factor, the G. And so I differentiate that, and I pick up the A. And then the other terms, I keep the first term, just the K term, right? But I also can differentiate the X's in the top equation. And that'll give me a second term, which is G alpha beta of zero. This is, of course, eta now, multiplied by L alpha mu lambda L, K beta nu plus K alpha mu L nu lambda beta. And that's all. So we'd like to, these L's are still free. I haven't used them up. Sorry, that's a different L. Maybe I should call this one something else. Let me call this small L. Let me call that small L. Okay, sorry about that. That was the diagonal matrix we used just to set all the eigenvalues of the metric. Sorry? Sorry, we're here? Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. G prime is eta. G is still G. Okay, so we want to know, can I solve this equation? All right, can we solve this for L? Can we solve for L's? Okay, so in other words, I want to choose this object such that it cancels the first term. Yes, that's right. So you see these A's are given. I mean, these are a property of the original metric. I can't change that. Okay, A is just some given first derivative of the original metric. And now I'm trying to set the first derivative of the new metric zero, and the only freedom I have is to adjust the coordinate transformation. In other words, adjust L. So can we solve for the L's? Well, given what we just did on the algebra over there, can you give me the answer? We did something up here, right? We had a three-index object, symmetric, comprising two terms like this, right? Which were one of which was symmetric on these two indices, should look pretty similar to the equation up there. So how do I solve that equation for the L's? I cycle the indices, I add the same equation three times, I cancel off two of the terms, and yes. Okay, just as above. Above. Okay, so but now we're going to go on. So we managed to do a coordinate transformation, which, let me label the above so just that it's clear. This is all the stuff we did above. Okay. And it's exactly the same algebra. Now, we're going to go on, which is to say, great, we've managed to turn this metric into flat Minkowski space. The first derivative we canceled. Well, let's just try and keep going. Can we set the second derivative of the metric to zero? And we will discover a fundamental obstacle. Now, before we do that, let's just ask a question about parameters. Okay, there are a certain number of numbers here. Maybe even go back right to the beginning. So general 4x4 matrix, well, let's do it for D by D. Let's be ambitious. So the metric has a symmetric D by D matrix. How many parameters does it have? How many independent parameters in a D by D symmetric matrix? DD plus 1 over 2, right? Okay, because you've got the diagonal, which is D, and then you've got the off-diagonal, which are DD minus 1 over 2, and you add the diagonal to one of the off-diagonal sets, and you get DD plus 1 over 2 parameters. Now, when we define our coordinate transformation, we have a certain number of parameters in it. We had the k, and we had the k in particular. How many k's do we have? How many parameters are those k's? Certainly the way we solved it. You see the O matrix. The O was an orthogonal matrix. So that has DD minus 1 over 2 parameters, right? And then the L has D parameters, the diagonal parameters, right? So we used exactly the right number of parameters to remove all of these guys and set them equal to 1s, minus 1. Okay, so DD plus 1. Over 2. So we used exactly the right number of parameters to remove all those parameters. What about the first derivatives? Well, we had A alpha beta gamma. Now, by definition, A is symmetric because G is symmetric in alpha and beta. So here we have D different gammas. So we have DD plus 1 over 2 times d parameters. Okay, so the number of possible first derivative parameters in the first derivatives is d squared, d plus 1 over 2 times d. And we removed all those with the l's, delta, right? So here we have, again, symmetric under gamma and delta, and a free index, another index alpha. So this also has d plus 1 over 2. So it's not too surprising that you can remove all the first derivatives because you have enough parameters to play with. But what about the second derivatives? Okay, so this was a very fundamental discovery Riemann made. Well, when the second derivatives are all encoded in that matrix B. Okay. So B, what are the properties of B? Well, it's symmetric under alpha and beta, and it's symmetric under lambda and sigma. Okay. So we can tell how many independent components it has by thinking about alpha and beta together as one index, okay, which takes d plus 1 over 2 values, and lambda sigma similarly as another index, which happens to take d plus 1 over 2 values. So here we have 1 quarter d squared d plus 1 squared parameters. Now, when we do our coordinate transformation, the only parameters we have at the order which might cancel these guys, or cancel the second derivatives of G prime, are the m's. Okay, m, alpha, gamma, delta, epsilon. That's all we've got. And you notice it's a very different object. Right? The M is symmetric under these three indices. Okay, so this is symmetric here. And a three-index object symmetric under its indices has 1/6 d, d plus 1, d plus 2 independent values. Okay, so I encourage you to just convince yourselves that's true. The easy way to do these calculations is something called Young Tableau. Have you come across those? It's okay, so it's worth learning about. Young Tableau. It's a basic technique in group theory. And the rule is that if I have some tensor, let's say I give you a tensor, T-I-J-K, with a certain number of indices, and some of them are symmetric, and some of them are anti-symmetric. Okay. You can work out how many different components there are by drawing boxes. Okay. So the rule is you draw boxes with the number of boxes equal to the number of indices. Number of boxes equals number of indices. Boxes are in the same row if the tensor is symmetric under exchanging them. Boxes are vertically separated, are vertical relative to each other, if the object is anti-symmetric. Okay, so let's do this. We've got 5 indices, I'm just trying to remember the rule. Yeah, I can't quite. I'm doing a specially complicated case. Let me do a simple case where I only have symmetric or I only have anti-symmetric. Okay, this would be a symmetric tensor. This would be anti-symmetric. And so the rule is you take these boxes, you need to know how many dimensions you're in, what the d is, and you put d here, and then d plus 1, d plus 2 in this row of horizontal boxes. So, and then you multiply all the box values and divide by what are called hooks. Okay, I realize it's a bit of a digression. I'm sorry about that. But the hooks are, you draw these lines which come in from the right, and you see the hooks. This hook goes through one box, this is through two boxes, this is through three boxes. Multiply the hooks and you get 6. Multiply the boxes and you get the numerator. Okay. And similarly, for an antisymmetric tensor, let's for fun work out the number of independent components of a 3-index antisymmetric tensor. Again, I put d here. But for antisymmetric, I put d minus 1, d minus 2. And then the hooks come in like this. So this goes through 3, 2, 1. So this one gives you 1/6 d, d minus 1, d minus 2. Okay, so that's a digression, but I encourage you to learn about Young Tableau at some point. In any case, it's pretty easy to convince yourself this is right. Just write out all the values. Okay, for d equals 1, 2, 3, and eventually you'll convince yourself this is correct. Let's see, for example, if d is 1, there's only one value for the index, this better equal 1. Right? Well, 1 times 2 times 3 over 6 is 1, so that's good. if there are two indices, you know, we have 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. So it better give us 4. 2 times 3 times 4 over 6 is 4. So QED. Okay. Must be true. All right. So here we have D. Indices.
If you use the fact that you don't have to be cubic and d, you could just do one more data point.
That's true. That's true. Yes. So we could do the 3. I won't bother. Okay. So the point of all this is that the number of parameters we have at our disposal are d squared over 6 times d plus 1 d plus 2. But we're trying to use these parameters to set all of these numbers to 0. And you obviously can't do that. Whatever you do, there's going to be more freedom over there than you have over here to cancel. And this was Riemann's basic discovery, and that showed him there must be some second derivatives of the metric which cannot be set 0 by any coordinate transformation. And so the number of second derivatives which cannot be, well, it's really the number of parameters. Parameters representing second derivatives of the metric, which cannot be set 0 by any coordinate transformation, equals, and so it's just this number minus that number. And so that is, we can pull out the d plus 1, and then we need to subtract 1/4 d plus 1 minus 1/6 d plus 2. This is 1/4 d squared minus 1/6 d squared. Let's move it up. This is, so this is d squared over 12. Sorry, it's 1/12 d minus 1. And so the result is d squared over 12 d squared minus 1. And so if we make a little table over here, the number of second derivatives parameters, and d, when d is 1, there is 0. You can set all the first derivatives to 0. When d is 2, there is 1. When d is 3, there are 6. And when d is 4, there are 20. So there are 20 second derivatives of the metric that cannot be set 0, or parameters describing second derivatives of the metric which cannot be set 0 in any coordinate transformation. So this was the clue to Riemann that somehow these second derivatives were the key to describing the curvature of space. Okay, it's pretty obvious. If space is curved locally, you can describe it as flat, but as you go out to second order in the distance, you would begin to see the effect of the curvature, and that should be encoded in these 20 second derivatives of the metric, which are intrinsic and cannot be set to zero under any coordinate transformation. So we're going to find the tensor which encodes this freedom. And oh, good idea. Let me just write down one equation, and then we will stop. Except I don't have it. Let me just write this one thing down. So it will turn out that there exist coordinates in the neighborhood of any point. These are called Riemann normal coordinates. Such that the metric g mu nu x is equal to eta, Minkowski metric, minus 1/3 r mu alpha nu beta x alpha x beta plus order x cubed, where this guy is the Riemann tensor. Okay, so very explicitly, Riemann showed that there is a tensor which you can define intrinsically on the manifold. And this tensor has exactly this number of components, has all kinds of symmetries which give it that number of components. And this tensor describes the curvature of the space. Yep, you had a question.
In the case of the first derivatives in the second board here, use the fact that this equation for g prime at 0 was anti-symmetric in one index. You just hit it now. You just hit it.
Oh, I hit it, sorry.
It's symmetric in two indices and anti-symmetric in one. So you argue that you can solve for L to make that equal to 0.
Yes.
So, but here in the second derivative case, just because you have that amount of m's to play with doesn't mean
Oops.
It's a.
Yeah, it's a nice one down. This is always difficult. Rear.
Yeah. So yep. just because you have, I mean, how do you know you can
actually solve the equation?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it seems like
no,
minimally that many.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's all I know. So you would need to play around with the explicit expressions to really show you can solve the equation. I haven't done that. All I've shown is there's an obstruction. It's a basic obstruction. No matter what I do, I won't be able to solve for, I won't be able to remove all the second derivatives, because I simply don't have enough parameters.
So it's possible, like in this four dimensions.
It's a no-go, that's all. It's a, it doesn't.
This 20 is like unreachable. It's possible?
No, because actually you can solve that equation.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought.
I just didn't do it.
Okay.
I just didn't do it. But you can solve the equation. In fact, this is Riemann's statement. Okay, so the statement I gave at the end, I mean, we'd have to play around with tricks like that one, except with one more index. So it's much more complicated. And that's what Riemann did. By the way, I think it was his PhD thesis. So what Riemann showed is this last statement. So that's exactly what Riemann did.
Okay.
So he said, well, he did more than that, because he interpreted what this coefficient was. So what he showed is that there is a tensor on the manifold describing the second derivatives of the metric. And if it's not zero, you know, it cannot be set zero beyond this point. But everything else can be set zero, apart from this tensor, which has 20 components. So this was his big theorem. But the proof involves very similar steps to what we did, just more complicated. Break. Do you want to walk around for 5 minutes? Why not?
Sure. Here you say, I'm insisted that the metric changes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So if I insist on this, then I'm guaranteed that G prime mu nu. Right. If I have this equation, it clearly implies this, because these dx primes are just dx prime. Well, actually, the other way around. It implies this because this dx equals dx mu dx prime alpha dx alpha. Right. That's the coordinate transformation. So. This equation implies that so that's what I'm saying is that if I have this equation, then g mu nu dx mu dx nu, well, that is equal to g mu nu dx nu dx prime alpha dx nu dx prime beta dx prime alpha dx prime beta. And with this equation, this I'm defining to be g prime alpha beta. So this equation guarantees that one. And it shows it's sufficient. It does show the other way too. Let's see.
I think it does.
I think it does, because well, all of these are independent.
Yeah.
So
it's a two form which agrees whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. How does that statement at the top change when you have G mu nu instead of eta mu nu?
Which statement?
The most general corner transfer is satisfying.
You see, because in the case up there, we insisted this guy was the same as this. And we only allowed coordinate transformation such that this is the same as that. But they're both eta. In this case, we don't do that. We say, I will just accept this as G prime, whatever it is. Okay? So there's a big distinction. So in other words, there's no constraint on this at all. The coordinate transformations are totally arbitrary. So what Einstein realized is that in special relativity, you only allow a class of coordinate transformations. And those ones take one inertial frame into another. Within an inertial frame, the laws of physics always take relativistic form in any inertial frame. Then he wanted to describe curved space and gravity. And this was a big conceptual leap, is he said, let us just accept that any coordinate system is valid. See, and physically, I'll talk about this on Monday, but physically, the big change was the following. Even Newtonian mechanics has a similar coordinate freedom, which is the Galilean transformation. You can change things by a constant velocity, or you can translate, and the laws of physics don't change. But what Einstein realized is that if I make a coordinate transformation, which is not, you see, changing things by velocity in Newtonian physics would be like this, right? I change t prime to t. So according to Newton, time is just God-given, and you can't change time. But you can change space by a constant velocity, and then all the equations are invariant. Now, what Einstein realized is that let's put 1/2 gt squared there. Okay? Let's do a coordinate transformation, which is quadratic in t. And then this turns out to be the gravitational acceleration. Okay, so just take this equation, x double dot, something falling in gravity is gm. Plus some other force. Let's call that electric or something, some other force. Imagine you've got a particle moving under gravity with some other force. Make this coordinate transformation. Probably got the sign wrong. No, I think I had it right, actually. So then m x prime double dot would be mx double dot minus gm, which would be f electric. Okay, so the x prime particle doesn't see any gravity. Okay. So that is a coordinate transformation, which is saying that, you know, it only works for uniform gravitational fields. So I put a collection of balls in the room, and I let them all go, and they're all falling under gravity. And now I say, how do I really know there was a gravitational field? Well, they're all accelerating. But then I say, well, let me just do a coordinate transformation. So that I am accelerating downwards. And then they'll all look like there's no gravity. And that was Einstein's sort of basic insight. So that led him to say, let's look for coordinate transformations which are more general than Lorentz. And if somehow if we do that, maybe we'll discover we've got gravity. And so then you had to ask, well, what is the mathematical context in which coordinates don't matter? And the context is if I've got curved spaces, which I put coordinates on, and then I can put any coordinates I like, but what matters is the geometry of the surface, not the coordinates. So these arguments sort of led him to this.
There's no restriction on that?
None at all. No restriction on, there's no restriction on X prime on. There's no restriction on the coordinate transformation at all. In fact, I won't do it in this course, but if you study conformal symmetry, you impose, which is sort of halfway in between these two things, you impose an equation similar to that. In conformal symmetry, you consider transformations x prime mu of x such that dx prime mu dx, dx mu dx prime mu dx alpha dx prime beta eta mu nu. So this is the metric in the new coordinate system. And you insist that that is any function of x times eta mu nu. That's called a conformal transformation. It just changes the metric by a factor here called the conformal factor, because conformal transformations, you know, in complex analysis do not change angles. They just change lengths. So that's what this does. It changes lengths, but not angles. And if you impose this, then you get a much bigger group than the Poincaré group. But it's still a finite group. And actually, it's a very, very beautiful group. And Maxwell equations satisfy that symmetry. So, and almost certainly this is how to make sense of physics without scale is going to be the physics of the future. But at the moment, we don't really know how to implement conformal theories in a realistic way. Okay, so let's continue. So we'll do a little bit more math, and then hopefully on Monday we'll be ready to do some physics. Okay, so our picture of space-time is going to be some kind of curved surface with with a metric g mu nu. And of course, the basic clue that led Einstein to this thought that maybe gravity is just the curvature of spacetime is the fact that objects of all mass fall in exactly the same way in gravitational fields. And so it suggests that what's causing them to fall is something which applies universally to all objects. And what would be not more natural than to have the geometry of space and time be deformed, and that actually be gravity?
So,
the picture, the physical picture, if you like, of this curved space is something which is independent of any coordinates. But we can't actually do any calculations on it unless we introduce coordinates. Okay, so we introduce coordinates, which you should think of as just some kind of arbitrary grid. And the one thing we have to do is to ensure that anything we calculate does not in the end depend on whatever coordinates we use. And so maybe one day there will be a form of intelligent being that can do calculations without coordinates. Okay. Currently they don't exist. But we all know that the answer we want to get should not depend on the coordinates. And so typically what happens, and this happens everywhere across physics, is people actually do the calculations in some awful, messy coordinate system, but then when they publish the result, they try to remove all of that and to say this is really beautiful and elegant. And they, no, it's a good thing to do, but it's really reality. I mean, for example, when Donaldson published his statements about very important theorems about manifolds, all of those were done in sort of very brute force, ugly coordinate system calculations, but the result all framed in geometrical and much more elegant language. So don't be afraid of coordinates. You have to use them, but you also have to hate them. And so when you've got your result, try to make sure it's true in any possible coordinate system, and if possible, phrase it in some way which doesn't even mention the coordinates. Okay, so let us discuss tensors on manifolds. Okay, so this is what a manifold is. Manifold is a curved, some kind of curved space, which locally looks like flat space, and locally looks, in the case of general relativity, space-time would locally resemble Minkowski space to very high accuracy at every point. And then we're going to put tensors on this space-time. And the tensors, again, to do calculations with them, we're going to need coordinates. So what are these tensors? Well, the simplest tensor is a scalar. And if we have a two-coordinate system, so this is a typical situation. Well, let me do it over here. So we have coordinates which are arbitrary. Let's imagine that I have some coordinate system x. And this is x prime. And so this is some kind of grid. This is another kind of grid. And generally, we will try to describe the same object in both coordinate systems. And we are going to have to be able to go from one coordinate system to another. And so when we do that, we need some transformation law, which relates any tensor in the first coordinates to a tensor in the second coordinates. So for scalars, the relation is extremely simple and obvious, which is to say that at any point in space-time, which is called x in one coordinate system and it's called x prime in the other coordinate system, at any point in space-time, there's a value, which is phi of x. Okay? So then it's very obvious and intuitive that the value you assign to the quantity at a given point in space-time should be the same in all coordinate systems. Okay, so that's the transformation law for scalars. We have vectors. And vectors, the simplest example of a vector is the derivative, d by d x mu. And so we would want that something like that, which has contracted indices, has two contracted indices, we'd want that to be a scalar. Okay, that should not, the value of this should be the same no matter what coordinate system I write. And of course, we know how to relate d by dx prime to d by dx. So this is a vector. The vector is, well, we usually call the components of this vector are called contravariant vector v prime mu of x prime. And you can read off from this that of course, d by dx prime, d by dx is dx prime alpha dx mu d by dx prime alpha. That's just the chain rule. And so it follows, because each of these components are independent, each of these d by dx's are independent, it follows that v prime mu of x prime is dx prime alpha dx mu v mu of x. Okay, so we're interested in vectors. We can think about them in a coordinate scalar form, which would be in this form, or we could think about the components of the vector, which are these objects with an index, and the components transform in this way. Similarly, we have covariant vectors, components. And a classic example is if I take just the derivative of a scalar, that's an object which has an index downstairs instead of upstairs. And similarly, we can work out, so W prime mu would be this. And that's, of course, dx prime mu dx alpha d by dx alpha phi of x. And so the components of a covariant vector transform the opposite way. In other words, with the inverse Jacobian matrix, dx prime mu w alpha of x. These are just examples. These are the transformation laws for contravariant and covariant vectors. And the way to remember which one is which is that trees are up and valleys go down. So contravariant is upstairs and covariant is downstairs. Okay. And so similarly, we can write down a tensor with any number of indices, or tensor components with any number of indices. similarly, T prime alpha beta gamma dot 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 mu nu dot 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 of x prime, and this will be dx prime alpha dx rho dot some dx prime dx's, some dx dx primes, t rho psi dot 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 of x. So that's the general transformation law for a tensor with a certain number of upstairs indices, a certain number of downstairs indices. The upstairs indices transform transform with the dx prime dx, and the downstairs with the dx dx prime. Rules of tensor algebra are very obvious. If T and S are tensors, then one, if they have the same number of indices of contravariant and covariant indices, then they add to form, we can take, then T plus S is a tensor. And actually, any linear combination is obviously a tensor, because the whole transformation law is linear. There's an operation called outer multiplication, in which you leave all the indices alone. And that obviously gives you a tensor with many more indices. So this is a tensor. There is inner multiplication. Where you contract the indices. This is also called contraction. And that just means you sum upstairs and downstairs indices. So for example, mu nu s mu beta dot 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 is a tensor with indices nu dot 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 and beta dot dot dot, etc. And the point is that when you contract two indices, the result is a scalar, it doesn't transform at all. And the reason for that is that this matrix dx prime mu, dx prime nu, dx beta is just delta mu nu. So the Jacobian matrix and its inverse, obviously when you multiply them, you just get one. And so when you contract these two indices, this guy is going to transform with the Jacobian, this with the inverse. Contract the two indices, you just get one. So the coordinate transformation disappears. They really should be the same. Oh, sorry, did I get that wrong? Yes.
Which are obvious.
think about them. Nevertheless, we will use them again and again if a tensor is zero in any one coordinate system. It is zero in all coordinate systems. Okay, so that's obvious, because if the tensor is zero in one coordinate system, all other coordinate systems are obtained just by performing coordinate transformations. All those do is introduce some Jacobian matrices times the original objects, and was zero. It's just going to stay zero. That's a very useful fact, because you just need, if you want to prove something, all you have to do is prove it in one coordinate system. If you can prove something is zero in one coordinate system, then it's automatically zero. It's a tensor quantity, it's automatically zero in all coordinate systems. By the way, that means that if two tensors are equal in one coordinate system, then they're equal in any coordinate system. I can make a tensor which is the one minus the other. And that's zero in one coordinate system, so it must be zero in any coordinate system. Another one that is useful is the quotient rule. Which says that if some tensor contracted if I have some statement like this, that a tensor contracted with some other tensor is zero for all SU, okay, then T mu is zero. Again, that's pretty obvious, because for SU, I could pick a vector, I can pick anything. So I can pick a vector with only a time component. And then that proves that T mu 0, 0. All right, in the space direction, x direction, and that proves T mu x equals 0. And so on. So we will use this in particular in calculations of the Riemann tensor. So I think, I want to do one final thing. So we don't have much so far. We've got a curved space. We can measure distances. We can put tensors on it. We can do algebra on these tensors. We can't yet do calculus. Okay, so on Monday we're going to begin to do calculus on this space. But we can do one other thing, which is the volume. We can measure volumes. Okay, all we have to do to measure volumes is to decide, the metric measures distances, so it's very natural to use the metric to measure volumes. To define a geometrical volume element, we just use the fact that that we can choose coordinates in which g mu equals eta at a point. And let's call those coordinates x flat. So there's some particular coordinate system which, for any given point, will ensure that g is eta at that point. Now, what is the volume element? Well, the volume element on Minkowski space time is the obvious one. The volume element would be dx naught flat, dx1 flat, dx2 flat,
x3 flat, just d3x dt. It's the volume element of space-time. It's Lorentz invariant because the transformation of the volume element under Lorentz transformations involves lambda. So the Jacobian matrix would just be lambda. And you know the volume element changes by a Jacobian determinant, which is that lambda, just plus or minus one. So this volume element is certainly invariant under Lorentz transformations with determinant one. And if I include the modulus sign, it would be invariant under all Lorentz transformations. So this is determinant of dx, a dx, dx a flat, dx mu, d4x mu. So if I decide to go from flat coordinates to any other coordinates, that's the rule of volume elements transform under, the Jacobian rule. But we also have that g mu in these non-flat coordinates is x a flat, x b flat, dx mu, dx mu, eta and b. And so it follows that the determinant, just take the determinant of both sides, determinant of eta is minus one. Determinant of a product of matrices is the product of the determinants. So I see that the determinant of dx a flat by dx mu is equal to the square root of minus g, okay, where g, by definition, is the determinant of g mu. And so it follows that the volume element on space-time is root minus g in any coordinate system times d4x. Okay, so that is a coordinate-independent volume element, which I've inferred just from the volume element in the locally flat coordinates. So that we'll use everywhere, in particular when you want to define an action in general relativity, an action principle, you need to be able to integrate over space-time, and that's the volume element we shall use. So I'll stop there. Is there any questions? I think we've got a class this afternoon. Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
If you can extend the transformation to any transformation, how can you prove that the signature of the metric remains invariant?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think that's guaranteed. Because the one thing you... to know why is the signature invariant under an arbitrary coordinate transformation.
I just looked it up on Wikipedia. So there's this theorem that's called Sylvester's law of inertia.
Okay.
And it states that any symmetric matrix retains the values of its eigenvalues if the transformation is invertible.
Oh, I see. Okay. Sylvester's theorem.
Sylvester's theorem.
Okay, thank you.
Saved by the bell. Okay. Yes, so I think this is just guaranteed. It's a theorem of matrix algebra. That, I guess it's just saying that any linear transformation is never going to change the signature of a matrix, meaning the sign of its, the set of signs of its eigenvalues.
Why is the determinant over there written in square root of negative g?
Oh, sorry, I went a little bit quickly. So what I did is I took the determinant of both sides of this equation, right? So on the left-hand side, I get what I call G. I just took the determinant of this 4x4 matrix. That's what I define to be G. On the right-hand side, I get the determinant of this guy squared, that of dx A flat dx mu squared, right? Because there are two factors here. And then I get the determinant of eta. So eta is -1, 1, 1, 1. So the determinant is -1. So I get -1. Okay. So I take the minus sign over here and take the square root. And it's saying that the determinant of this guy is square root of minus 2. I need to put the minus sign in there because G has signature minus plus plus plus. So its determinant is all, the determinant of G is always going to be negative, just because it has one negative eigenvalue and three positive. So I've got to multiply by minus before I take the square root, otherwise I won't get a real number. Any other questions? Okay, well, we've actually covered quite a lot of ground this week, so I'm very pleased with that. I hope you have a good rest this weekend. I'm going to see you refreshed on Monday.